97.1 FM Talk. On-demand audio.
Welcome in Peter Zane to the program because he's written a little bit recently about the media. We can plenty to talk about with the way that everything has been treated, even in the last week in the aftermath of the second assassination attempt. He's an editor at Real Clear Investigations, a columnist for Real Clear Politics. And have you written, now this last column that you wrote, Peter, how are you? Welcome to the show, but I had a question.
Shoot.
The piece that you wrote in the New York Times, is that taken from a book that you have written?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
There's a collection of essays edited by Michael Walsh, and it's called Against the Corporate Media, and it's got 42 essays in it. One of them was mine, and mine was The Sins of the Gray Lady.
That's where I was confused, because when I pulled the book up, it said, it didn't say your name, it said edited by Michael Walsh. Now it all makes sense. So we're going to find out a couple of the ways that the press hates you, but you kind of highlighted the New York Times. And look, you wrote something in here that really was relatable. And you probably know this, Peter. I talk about this media bias all the time. But you said that rather than serving as an honest broker whose mission is to provide readers with the information needed to make decisions about important issues, the New York Times instantly puts its thumb on the scale, both in terms of the stories covered and those ignored. And that, by the way, is a very important part, those ignored. By replacing skepticism with ideology, the Times seeks to not inform, but to persuade. Its aim is to not reflect society, but to transform it. And views to the contrary are verboten, beyond the pale of acceptable discourse. Everything you wrote there is completely accurate. But I'd go further, because it's not just the New York Times. It seemingly is all of the legacy media right now, isn't it?
I agree. I mean, I think that the Times is especially important, and people who are not in the media can, you know, wonder why we who are in the media are so obsessed on the New York Times. But part of it is because we know it really does set the agenda for NPR, ABC, Washington Post, the newspapers that pick up its story. So it, to a large degree, not solely, but really sets the agenda for the dominant media. And that's why what it does and what it says is acceptable and not acceptable. Imagine if the New York Times had a whiff of skepticism of Russiagate and it found out early on, which of course it could have, that Hillary Clinton was behind all these charges, which they actually kind of maybe even knew. There was some reporting on that, but they could have snuffed that story out right away. But instead, they ran with it, and they have that kind of power.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's interesting because I haven't seen this in New York Times, but I'll use the Washington Post as an example because I was rather surprised by something they did recently. So if you go back to the end of May, and I don't know how much you've tracked this, but this is one of my favorite stories here of the last couple of weeks. The NOAA and the climate alarmists out there, Peter, they predicted that this was going to be the worst Atlantic hurricane season like ever in history.
Right.
And not only has it not been, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been the least active hurricane season in recorded history, the least active. Now, the stories were in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all these things from May and June. Oh, it's going to be a terrible hurricane season. To the Post's credit, the Washington Post, they've done two stories recently that said what happened to the predictions of a, quote, historic hurricane season. That's actually shocking to me, because usually you won't see a clarification on a story that they mess up so much. And that's why when you said what they cover and those ignored is so important, because when they ignored, that's the same thing. They're putting that editorial thumb on the scale and saying, nope, nothing to see here, right?
Well, I'll also tell you, one of the things that I go into is a story that we wrote, Aaron Maté wrote for Real Clear Investigations, that talked about falsehoods in the Russiagate coverage. And we spent a lot of time really going line by line in the coverage that the Post and the Times submitted to win a Pulitzer Prize. And they are so devious in the ways that they will add small lines with caveats, or sort of flicking at the truth, or maybe an argument against what they're trying to say. So they're devious in that when you go back and say, well, you never said this, they go, well, no, we actually, you know, in the 100 stories that we ran on climate change, one of them actually said there are people who are skeptics. Or in the Russiagate thing, we said one line that's, well, all of this hasn't been completely confirmed. But this gets lost in the broad sweep of what the power of narrative is. And I'll give you the best example. Politico, on that story about the Hunter Biden laptop, says 51 intelligence officers say this is Russian disinformation. you read the story and it's like, well, they don't know, they haven't seen it. But anybody reading that headline, which was the message that then got picked up everywhere, was they say this is what it is. So you really got to read this stuff closely. They are unbelievably skillful at protecting themselves, at offering a lie while doing just enough to protect themselves so that they can pretend that they actually
Absolutely.
Told the truth.
That is such an accurate statement there. Look, I would say that we're getting an example of all of this right now with what's happening in Springfield, Ohio. Now, I can't tell you that there's people eating, you know, dogs and cats, Haitians, but what I can tell you is there's been some pretty horrible things that have happened in that community, and there is an unwillingness on the part of the New York Times and the rest of the legacy media to actually go and do some reporting and ask people, instead of David Muir citing, this is one of my favorite lines from a week ago, David Muir says, well, we called the city manager. Who the F cares what a stupid city manager that's probably going to vote for Kamala Harris anyway is going to say? That's not reporting. That's not journalism. But that's modern day journalism, apparently, especially when there's an agenda, Peter.
Well, I mean, I would also, this is my next column, so I hope that all of my competitors aren't listening. But, you know, really what you think about is how much time first did we spend on the Arlington Cemetery? And then once that died down, and admittedly Trump mentioned this at the debate, but this has been 10 days, one, you know, just on the claim about the pets, and certainly not on the 20,000 people that have been dumped into this tiny community.
Right.
But, I mean, think about all the things we're not talking about, because the media is focusing the conversation on nonsense. We now have service on the national debt is $1 trillion a year.
I know. Yeah.
There was a report the other day about China is engaged in, you know, warlike conduct with the Philippines, who is a longstanding ally of ours. So, you know, you got to ask yourself, do you want Kamala Harris? Do you think she can stand up to these people? And so what I would take, you know, Elon Musk sent out some tweet about, and he doesn't certainly read what I'm saying in his tweets, but, you know, about the Ohio thing. And I was like, this is a diversion. This is a tactic to get us talking about stuff that doesn't matter so that we don't say to Harris and to Trump, who also is very short on details, you know, what are you going to do? We are a world that is in trouble. We have massive issues, and I don't know when those bills are going to come due, but they're going to. And that's what we should be selecting somebody for, not nonsense about Arlington Cemetery. So that's how they're really devious, is that they focus attention on nonsense to distract us so that we don't ask Kamala in particular the hard questions.
What do you think? This is something I highlighted earlier. Maybe I'm kind of, you know, getting too far ahead of myself here because I mentioned I was going to use it for cut of the day, but I thought this was an interesting moment with Peter Doocy and KJP in the press room yesterday.
How many more assassination attempts on Donald Trump until the president and the vice president and you pick a different word to describe Trump other than threat?
Peter, if anything from this administration, I actually completely disagree with the premise of your question. The question that you're asking, it is also incredibly dangerous in the way that you're asking it.
What?
And now for you to make that kind of comment in your question, because your question involved a comment and a statement. And, you know, it is, that is also incredibly dangerous. But when you start bringing political rhetoric, that is not okay.
Okay, so that was a complete word salad. You can kind of hear the wheels spinning, and she didn't know really how to get out of it.
Slowly.
But, you know, the other thing is, and this is what happened at the debate, actually both debates, what I said earlier on the show is I think that they're pretty comfortable at the White House knowing that any kind of exchange like that won't be covered widely at all. When they mention Charlottesville and continue to lie about that, it's not going to matter because no one's going to put that in a clarification or a fact check. So they can get away with a lot of things that the other side probably can't get away with because they're going to just move on and say nothing to see here and protect the Democrats.
Well, and I mean, you know, the other thing that we have to remind ourselves, there's a poll that says 28% of Democrats, you know, think the country would be better off if the assassin's bullet had taken Trump out. So, you know, when you ask them a question like that, they don't see it as heightened rhetoric. They don't see it as dangerous talk. They think he's Hitler. They wish he were dead.
Yeah.
They are sad that that guy stopped, a bunch of them. And so they don't understand, you know, we're looking at it as he's a guy, he's the pick of half the country, he's running for president, you're saying these terrible things, and it could set somebody off. And they think, no, we're describing him. I think they really believe, they believe the nonsense, the ugly things they say about him. And when you do, then, you know, it's like that old question about evil. And, you know, if somebody doesn't think he's evil, if the slave master thinks he's doing the slave a favor because he's civilizing him, is he actually evil if he doesn't have consciousness of evil in his mind? And I just throw that out because they believe all the stuff that they say about him, which is insane. They're deranged. And it's, I don't know how you come back from that.
How do you, I want you to explain this, because when you wrote recently, Peter Zane is back with us from Real Clear Investigations and Real Clear Politics. You said this about the election. Americans are not facing a choice this November between two competing visions, but about the pace of our decline. Explain that a little bit.
I don't think that Donald Trump is a true conservative. I think he's a much better choice, and I think he will do some good things. But when you think about what's going on with our budget deficits, really what I was getting at was we have become a people who feel entitled. We are a people who feel the government owes us. We are people that have a grievance. And it's not all made up. People have grievance. People may feel they're entitled to certain things. But that question John F. Kennedy asked, ask not what you can do for your what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, that's gone. Trump is a grievance candidate, and I agree he's got a lot to be, you know, to have grievance about. Harris is a grievance candidate. And the traditional mythology of America, mythology is not always false, is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And that is gone. And if you want to go a step further, the Judeo-Christian tradition of you don't sin. You have a choice about what your actions are. What are you going to do? I'm not saying there aren't a bunch of people that feel that way, but the sweep of this country has rejected that. And there's no choice in the candidates. It's just a question of who they think is screwing you. Is it this side or the other side?
Yeah, and I kind of understand that. No, and I get that. And here, look, I share your concern about the lack of attention to detail with some of these issues. And I'll take you back to 20 years ago when, and this is kind of sad to me, it really is, because I'm someone as a fiscal conservative that has cared about the debt and the deficit. I have cared and talked about extensively Social Security reform and Medicare reform. Social Security reform, perhaps a little easier than the latter. But 20 years ago, I was talking to this guy that is now verboten in Republican politics, Peter. He's just a rhino. He didn't want to talk about anything. We don't want to hear him. He's off the radar. The former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, because I was in Wisconsin, got to know him very well. He was working hard, especially in the latter part of that first Bush administration, to try to actually do something to fix some of these things. We've now kicked the can 20 years. There's no indication, to your point, that we're not going to kick it another 20 or 50 or 100 years. So where does that leave us?
The Wall Street Journal had an editorial or some piece that said we need to act on Social Security. This is the Wall Street Journal, and there was a page of letters, you know, half page, whatever. There were a bunch of letters. Every one of them was, don't you touch it. I'm owed that money. And
right.
I'm just thinking, you know, no one's willing to sacrifice. I'm not saying people who don't have, if you don't have anything to sacrifice, you can't sacrifice. But nobody, not nobody, but people don't want to step up. They feel they're entitled. They don't feel connected to the state in a way, into the future of the country. And the other thing I was just saying is, like, neither candidate, you know, Trump might be good for small business. He might get rid of regulation. But nobody has the Reagan-esque rhetoric of, I believe in you, and what I want to do is get out of your way. That message has disappeared. And that's what made this country great. That's why people came here from all over the world. And that's why people still come. And as I said in my piece, the irony is that native-born people have largely lost faith in America to a greater extent than the immigrants who come here.
Yeah.
And while we read stories about, oh, they're getting on this welfare program and that, you know, most of these people just, they want to work. They want a job. They just want to be able to take care of themselves. And they believe this country has that opportunity. And I think for many native-born people, you know, that's gone.
Well, you know, I mentioned this last year. I had not been in Western Europe in a while. I was in Barcelona last year and talking in Madrid and talking to some Spanish friends there. I said this when I came back. I said, some of these Europeans have a greater love for America than we do, I think.
Yes. Yeah, they do. I mean, because we still, you know, our great advantage, and this is a terrible advantage, is the rest of the world is in even worse shape. And I mean, really, with Kamala Harris, you know, Europe, the problems in Europe at bottom are, as Margaret Thatcher says, they have run out of other people's money. They are hamstrung. They have played every card. We still have some freedom. We still can run deficits in a way that they can't. So, you know, those bills haven't come due yet. But we, unfortunately, are continuing to mimic and become more like the countries that should be a cautionary tale for
us. I agree.
Canary in the coal mine, we're going towards it instead of running from it.
Yep, it's a problem, and I love having conversations like this because I agree wholeheartedly. And I now want to read this book. So your essay is in this book called Against the Corporate Media, 42 Ways the Press Hates You. I don't know how Michael would have narrowed it down to just 42 because I think we can go on from there, but that's what sequels are about. But Peter, thank you so much. I got to get a copy of that book. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.